Nation Star Mortgage, LLC, Satakoi Bay, case 70382 in Shadow Canyon, 69478. Pardon me, council have 40 minutes. I assume you've divided up your time or determined how to address that, but we'll hold it to 20 minutes aside. You ready to proceed?
Can I set a preference system which order?
It's up to you. Your argument.
Good afternoon. Justice Hardesty, Justice Spaghetti, Justice Stiglitz. Our arrangement here is we're going to split our time equally, 10 minutes between Mr. Jacobs and me. My intent is to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, so I will speak for about 8 minutes. And justices, in this appeal, we ask the court to reverse the district court's order on a couple of bases, and I'd like to spend the first few minutes of my time addressing the commercial reasonableness issue. That is an issue that we presented in the district court, and we believe the district court determining correctly for a couple of reasons. First, the district court, in our view, conflated the concept of commercial reasonableness with a minimal price. While the concepts are related, they're not the same. Commercial reasonableness does not arise from the common law. It arises from the statute. And as we explain in our briefing, it arises from NRS 116.1113. This is part of the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, and it is a statutory imposition of a good faith requirement that carries through the entirety of the obligations that both the associations and their agents, such as collection companies, have. As we explained in our papers, the concept behind the commercial reasonableness is borrowed from the Uniform Commercial Code. The commentary to the UCIOA makes this very clear. It explains that while the term good faith is not explained in the statute, it is borrowed directly from the Uniform Commercial Code and has the same meaning. So it's a statutory concept. The minimal sufficiency of price that we've had one published decision in the Shadowwood case and several unpublished orders is related but different. In the context of the minimal price, it's common law post-sale equity that looks at the sufficiency of the price. We will be asking the court in this case as well as in others, but particularly in this case, to follow the restatement approach for cases where the sales price is less than 20% without requiring an additional factor, such as unfairness, fraud, or oppression. But before we reach that, we want to make clear that these are separate, though related, separate concepts. Good faith, as required by NRS 116.1113, imposes a commercial reasonableness standard, and it's borrowed from the Uniform Commercial Code. And for that reason, this court's precedents in secure transactions under the Uniform Commercial Code that analyze the totality of the circumstances of the sale, including the price, but also the sufficiency of notice, the extent to which the secured party went to assure sufficient price, and all other factors are considered co-equally without requiring a showing of fraud, oppression, or unfairness in addition to a low price. That's what this court held in Golden versus Tomiyasu. But in the many cases that the court has applied the commercial reasonableness standard as it's set forth in the Uniform Commercial Code, that additional factor is not necessary. The court looks at the totality of circumstances. So we allege that the first error the district court made was...
We would disregard the holding in Golden as to foreclosures in the context of HOA foreclosures?
No, Justice Hardesty. I think the holding in Golden versus Tomiyasu, while the court did refer to it in Shadowwood and relied on it.
I was going to say it more than referred to it.
It certainly relied on it as well.
It was like a passing statement in the night.
It was more than that. I acknowledge that. However, I don't think that the Shadowwood case presented the circumstances we have here. Factually, that case was quite dissimilar from the Garden Variety Homeowner Association case because it involved the homeowner. The bank, even though it was a bank, had it already foreclosed. And so it stood in the shoes of an owner, not in the shoes of a third-party lien claimant.
Well, but in the context of a court revisiting the foreclosure, the HOA foreclosure, I understand your advocacy to be that we should apply concepts under the Uniform Commercial Code rather than the rules that this court has followed in Golden for years dealing with equitable reversals of foreclosures.
I'd like to make a few points in response to that, Justice Hart, because I think that's an important question and a fair point, but it has several points in response. The first one is, and this is why I stress that this arises from statute, your last statement there was equitable review of foreclosures. The duty of good faith under NRS 1113 is statutory. And so we're already asking the court to consider this as a statutory rather than a equitable balance. In addition to that, Justice Hardesty, we believe that the facts as presented in Chatterwood did not fully present the distinction or the dichotomy between the UCC approach and the Golden versus Tomoyasu approach. And the issues that we have with Golden are several. First, Golden was decided in 1963. That was decades before the Uniform Commercial, the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, decades before the restatement, decades before this court's SFR investments decision. And it just didn't foresee this unique, I think this court itself called it unique structure, where there is a lien that's partially senior and partially junior. Our lien, the deed of trust, is partially senior and remains partially senior. And part of the good faith that we believe the association needs to demonstrate is intended to protect that senior portion of the bank's deed of trust. NRS 1631162B, 2B, yes, preserves partial seniority for the deed of trust. However, in this case, and in every case that I know of, but for sure in this case, the distribution of proceeds went straight to the HOA. There wasn't a distribution of proceeds to the senior portion of the lien, and so that makes it functionally dissimilar from Golden. In addition, Your Honor, we believe that...
Isn't your remedy to access the proceeds rather than reversing the foreclosure?
No, Your Honor, because the proceeds are de minimis compared to what they could have been if the statute and the distribution of proceeds had been done properly before the sale, if the HOA had anticipated that. The HOA probably, we argued, would have needed to assure itself of a higher price. In other words, if it would pay itself after the deed of trust is paid, the way the normal distribution of proceeds goes in a normal sale, by seniority, there would be an incentive for the HOA to actually come much closer to market value than it did when it has the a priori assumption that it's going to pay itself into the entirety first, including the portion that's junior to the deed of trust. And in this case in particular, about $8,000 of that we've shown was constituted of illegal fines that it was, illegal is a strong word, contrary to the statute for them to foreclose on. So that's an additional factor, Your Honor. I think the real dichotomy between Golden versus Tomoyasu and the all factors commercial reasonableness approach that we asked the court to take, and I don't believe, I could be speaking a little bit out of school, Your Honor, but I don't believe that the legislative history and the commentary to the UCIOA was perhaps fully developed in Chatterwood. And this concept that this is a rule that springs from the common law, from the statutory law, from the Uniform Act express commentary that says expressly this is barred from the Uniform Commercial Code. And that's why we believe that the Vermont Supreme Court's decision in Will versus Mill Condo Association is spot on. To my knowledge, that's the only other court of last resort in one of the states that has considered the concept of commercial reasonableness. And they followed the approach consistent with the commentary. So for those reasons, Justice Hardesty, we don't believe that we would be upending Golden versus Tomoyasu. The last point I would make here is Golden versus Tomoyasu and the restatement approach are actually very similar. Both rules follow the concept that you don't overturn a sale on the basis of an insufficient legal price. The only real exception is that the restatement approach carves out an exception to the rule for very extreme circumstances, which Golden inflexibly, in our view, does not. And so by asking the court to follow either the restatement approach or an approach that emphasizes consideration of all circumstances, we don't believe we are inviting a radical departure for this court from decades of precedent. There would be a change, if at all, at the very margins. I would like to reserve the remainder of my, at this point, 45 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Maybe Mr. Stern will give you a minute of his time.
Good afternoon, Justice. May it please the Court, Andrew Jacobs for HSBC. I'd like to focus, in the brief time we have, on our idea that we should win this appeal and the case should be remanded because of the language of the recorded notices and what they necessarily mean, which is a real basic, straightforward thing, not asking you to reconsider principles or do something meaningfully different than what you've been doing recently. First, to start with the obvious, the notice doesn't say it was mailed to HSBC. It cites NRS 116 in detail with subparts, but not NRS 107. It's addressed to, quote, you, the homeowner. It's not putatively addressed to other non or third parties. But really, much more important than that, this court in January issued the important Santaquoi Bay decision, which I argued and lost. And in Santaquoi Bay, at page 974, the court made crystal clear that it was saying that we need not determine whether NRS 116, 3.116, et sec, incorporates the notice requirements set forth in NRS 107. We agree. The court hadn't reached that issue then. And the court really wouldn't have said that then if it really had said it in SFR versus U.S. Bank 3 years earlier. And I make this point not presently to argue about incorporation, but to say that we are interpreting a factual document here. The document that was recorded, which is the piece of evidence upon which this summary judgment was founded, is a deed upon sale. And that is a document which is factual, and it just says, I did what the law required me to do. But how can a document in 2012 that merely says I did what the law required me to do mean that they did whatever the law required them to do when it's going to be announced at some point later than June 2017? That does not make sense. This court is the authoritative expositor of Nevada law. This court has the authority to determine the meaning of the statute and to determine the issue of incorporation. But when this court en banc publishes a decision in 2017 saying we haven't gotten there yet, then what that means is that this recital does not on its face say, as a factual matter, that I intended to comply with NRS 107 and send required notices to secured lenders. It just doesn't say that, and it can't be made to bear that weight in light of the plain holding and the en banc unanimous decision in Santaquoi Bay. For that reason, this matter should be remanded, like other matters that Your Honors have handled recently, in which there simply was not affirmative evidence placed in the record to establish the absence of an issue of material fact. This record is very stark. This is a record where there was literally no discovery, and there was a Rule 56F request to take discovery. So what you have here is one of the most kind of barren arguments that you could advance on the side of the speculator cause. Many of these cases come to Your Honors that are sort of redolent with all kinds of complex stuff. This one, like a matter we had last year with Your Honors, a Premier One in 2016 matter, was a matter that had basically a four-page motion for summary judgment and a four-page reply. And litigants are entitled to be the masters of their theories. And as in that case, Premier One in this case decided to plant its flag solely on the effective conclusions in the recitals and nothing else. And that's their right, nothing wrong with that. But if they had put in evidence of actual mailing, and I know from litigating cases here in the trial court against other litigants like SFR, you know, we get the notices. You get to see if somebody give notice. That really gets determined. You get to see those notices when they're mailed. But here, for some reason, the issue was we're not going to provide that information. So we believe that
if you argue or raise the denial of the 56F request in your appeal to this court.
We mentioned that there was no discovery, but we did not independently argue the 56F, Justice Hartstein.
So why should we consider this?
Because we did argue that there was no discovery taken, and the lack of discovery means this is a record with nothing but a naked legal argument that is insufficient.
But you know that when there's an objection made to the district court's refusal to grant you a 56F request, you appeal that and you cite standards to the appellate court as to what's supposed to be done and why the court abused its discretion in not addressing it. I don't see that as even an appealable issue in your case.
In the absence of a Rule 56F request, you would still have the underlying legal issue, which is that there was summary judgment granted with no quantum of evidence upon which judgment can be founded. You don't need a Rule 56F request to appeal that summary judgment.
So what material facts exist in the record from your position?
position none, because there is no affirmative showing that there is an absence of issue of fact. There is affirmative showing that notice was mailed. There is a 2012 conclusory attestation that we did what the law requires without saying what that is. And given the 20 years in which the statute did not really develop, it would be prudent if you're buying a house for $9,000 to attest to whom you mailed your notices, or to attest that you complied with NRS 107, which was not done, probably because NRS 107 was not complied with in this case. And that's been our argument consistently below and in this court, Your Honor.
Okay.
As far as the incorporation goes, and we are mindful of the unpublished orders recently in which this panel has opined about the incorporation issue, we would respectfully argue that 107 is not incorporated into 116. For one thing, we see that, you know, in the Bourne Valley decision, and this panel has approvingly cited Judge Wallace's dissent, Judge Wallace did not locate in SFR versus U.S. Bank a place where that incorporation would have occurred. We also see that the Nevada legislature, which is the author of the statute, albeit as a litigant, in the Bourne Valley en banc rehearing proceeding, said three times in asking for that issue to be sent from the Ninth Circuit to Your Honors for decision that it was, quote, novel, meaning the incorporation issue had not yet been decided. And so also we would cite the decision of former Chief Judge Jones on this point from 2015 in U.S. Bank versus SFR. But even if Your Honors now decide that issue in 2017 and say, we're going to decide in our role as the authoritative expositors of Nevada law that that is incorporated, even if Your Honors were to do that, we would argue that because of the long period of time in which this has been in contest, these notices date from 2011, so we're now past 5 years, that the court, as was argued in Christiana Trust, apply that prospectively and not retroactively, because it would now affect a whole set of cases that have been pending for a great number of years. But even if I'm wrong about all of that, and even if incorporation happens, which we would argue is not correct, nothing changes the fact that the 2012 documents didn't know and therefore could not state what Your Honors decided either in 2014, as your recent panel decisions indicated about incorporation, or might decide in 2017, as I would argue it would be. In neither case, there's no one saying that incorporation was stated and known in 2012. So if you're writing a deed in 2012 and you just say, I followed the law, you were not incorporating a judicial decision from 2014 or 2017. That's just impossible. That's why this should be reversed. It's a pretty basic kind of argument from our point of view. Under Shadowwood as well, and you know, Your Honors gave us guidance in Shadowwood, this court should reverse for more issue development under Shadowwood. We acknowledge the longstanding rule of Long versus Town that mere inadequacy of price is not sufficient and requires more. Fair enough, 35-year-old case, we get it. But their argument is incorrect when they say that we've made no issue about notice. That's frankly about all we've done, is taken quarrel with the quantum of proof of notice in this record, Justices. That's all we're really saying. There is no proof here in this record of notice, and for that reason, you can't say that there's no issue of fact, and issue development is appropriate. And we've seen time and again this court give the lower courts opportunities to develop where there's insufficient issue development, further issues relating to disputes precisely like this. And we respectfully ask Your Honors to do that yet again, because this is, again, a bare legal argument in a four-page motion without an attempt to put in notices. If they exist, it would have been simple. They aren't there. Rule 56 is not satisfied, and the matter should be remanded. I'd like to ask if I could please reserve the 2:20 roughly showing on this clock, if I may.
For you or for your co-counsel?
Whatever part of it would be due to me, please, Your Honors.
Okay. All right.
If it pleases the court, Michael Bone on behalf of respondent Sataquai Bay LLC Series Shadow Canyon. I'm going to use 10 minutes of time and reserve the other 10 minutes of time for co-counsel Jacqueline Gilbert. In this case, Your Honor, I'm going to ask you to issue a published opinion that states some age-old common law rules that are applicable to quiet title HOA foreclosures as well as trustee foreclosures, and to clarify a lot of the common issues faced by the district court on a regular basis. I'm always going to ask you to apply some principles of law and equity to make some holdings which have not been made before but are otherwise supported by the authorities. Because the HOA foreclosure lien statutes are unique, there are some holdings specific to foreclosure law that should be made and can be justified by this court. I'd first like to point out that 116.1108 requires that the general rules of law and equity, including those of contract and real property, are applicable to Chapter 116. The general rules of law I'm going to ask you to state and apply to foreclosures have to do with presumptions, burden of proof, the availability of equitable relief, clean hands, and bona fide purchaser. I'm also going to ask you to make findings that the banks knew or should have known of the legal consequences of their failure to take any steps to protect their interests prior to the time of the sale, and that equity is not available in such circumstances, which is the unclean hands argument.
What about counsel's argument about not receiving any notice?
That is not in my case. That's the other case. The record is replete that the notice of lien was recorded and mailed. The notice of default was noticed and mailed to NationStar's predecessor. After the notice of default was recorded, NationStar received its assignment of the deed of trust, so they were on notice as a matter of law by the recording statutes of the foreclosure sale. And when the notice of sale went out, it did go to both the predecessor and to NationStar, so they did get notice in this case. I need to talk briefly about
commercial. I understand you answered Justice Perigary's question, but you made a statement before that question was posed about equitable relief. But counsel argues in your case that we should examine this whole issue anew under the Uniform Commercial Code, and that this is really a statutory basis for setting aside, considering whether to set aside an HOA foreclosure rather than an equitable determination.
Just going to get to that. Commercial reasonableness is a UCC standard. It's adopted under Chapter 104, not Chapter 116. There are two main differences between a UCC sale and a real property foreclosure sale. The UCC is specifically not applicable to land transactions. And the UCC covers a whole range of personal property, and that's why they have to have a commercial reasonable standard, because there's so many types of securities out there that could possibly be foreclosed on. You just have to make the reasonable, commercially reasonable standard for it. Whereas in a foreclosure action involving real property, both under trustees and the HOAs, method, manner, time, and place are all dictated by statute. The standard under UCC is method, manner, time, place, and terms. The only thing that's not covered by the statute is terms in a foreclosure sale. And even under the UCC cases, it's been held that the sale price by itself is enough to set the sale aside. And indeed, in the Savage Construction case, the court held that the public auction need not bring the highest possible price. In the Denison case, which is often cited, the court said the conditions of a commercially reasonable sale are to promote a sales price that is equitable to both the debtor and the secured creditor. So there's equity involved in looking at the price also. The other big difference between UCC sale and real property sale is in UCC sale, you often do not have junior lien holders who have an interest in the property. It's normally just the creditor, the secured creditor, and the debtor. In regards to the price, there's the Golden Case's long-standing case law from this court that they're asking you to set aside, and they haven't given good grounds. The UCIOA has always contemplated, and this is noted specifically in the 2014 report from the UCIOA, was always intended that once the bank got notice of the HOA sale, that they would pay it. They would add it to their deed of trust. They'd start collecting their own collection efforts against the homeowner. And the HOA would never have to go to sale, because the HOA, the trustee holder would go to sale and put a owner in there that would start paying the HOA dues in their future. This kind of situation that has occurred was not contemplated by the UCIOA, and that is stated as such in the 2014 report. If I may shift to equitable considerations, the one rule that I'm requesting the court make, and it's not anything unusual, it's a common law rule that you are not entitled to an equitable remedy if you have an adequate remedy at law. An adequate remedy at law is money damages. The rule also is, when there's a bona fide purchaser involved, the title of the purchaser is unassailable. Now, looking at the restatement, which they want you to adopt, the restatement is 17 pages long. They only cite the one sentence that is cited in Shadowwood. The restatement says, simply, if the real estate is unavailable because title has been acquired by a bona fide purchaser, the issue of price inadequacy may be raised by the mortgagor or junior interest holder in a suit against the foreclosing mortgagee for damages for wrongful foreclosure. This latter remedy, however, is not available based on gross price inadequacy alone. In addition, the mortgagee must be responsible for a defect in the foreclosure process of the type described in comment C of the section. So what this means is, if the property is acquired by a bona fide purchaser, their remedy is a money damages remedy against the lien holder or the foreclosing agent. And in all these situations, if there's a bona fide purchaser, they have no right to ask equitable relief from the court. So then it goes on to the next question is, what exactly is a bona fide purchaser? This is another matter I would request the court to clarify, because a BFP and a voluntary transfer is a completely different animal than a BFP and a forced sale. With a voluntary transfer, you take title to the property subject to anything that's of record. With a foreclosure sale, and especially when you have a foreclosure sale on a strong lien like an HOA lien, it wipes everything out. So you might be on notice of lien holders against the property before the sale, but after the sale, they are extinguished. Real estate finance law, which was cited by this court in the Shadowwood case, has a simple explanation that this court should adopt. It says, if the defective sale is only voidable, who is a bona fide purchaser? It goes on to say that if the sale purchaser paid value and is unrelated to the mortgagee, he should take free avoidable defects if A, he has no actual knowledge of the defects, B, he is not on reasonable notice from recorded instruments, and C, the defects are such that a person attending the sale and exercising reasonable care would be unaware of the defects. The defects that are often complained of in these cases are the notices didn't go out, the notices didn't go out timely, the notices didn't go in the wrong place. These are not the types of thing you would learn from reviewing the public record, and you would not learn of by attending the foreclosure sale. I'd also ask you to adopt the unclean hands argument. I only have 1 minute left. I'll try to make this fast, but the unclean hands argument would be, and this is touched upon in Shadowwood multiple times, the bank knew what was going on. The bank got notice, and the bank didn't do anything to protect their interest or stop the sale. They should be precluded, once notice is sent out, from asking this court for any equitable relief if they didn't take any steps to protect their own interest prior to the time the sale took place. I'm going to turn the time over now, unless the court has any questions of me. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jacqueline Gilbert on behalf of Preferred Equities. And the problem here is that we have what this court needs to clarify, we believe, and that why this should be affirmed is because there seems to be the banks wanting to shift all the burden to a purchaser to prove that the title that they have and the deed that they have is valid. And that simply isn't how the burdens work in property law. Title is presumed valid, brilliant be preferred. Equity, if I have title to the property, I should be able to show my title, and it's up to somebody who's challenging that title or challenging to say that their The sale under which their deed of trust was extinguished was not valid, and their deed of trust should be reinstated. That lies on the bank. It doesn't lie on the purchaser. The sale is presumed valid under 47.250, that the law was obeyed, title conveyed, and the transaction was fair and ordinary course of business was followed. You also have the conclusive recitals. And to say that, well, until this court decided what the statute meant, the statute didn't mean that. That's an absurd argument. I just don't see it. And you also get a deed without equity or right of redemption. And they're asking for equity. But reality is, you don't have to recite the facts in the deed. What you have is to be able to show the deed. Preferred doesn't need to bring in something to show that things were mailed to the bank. And this is what the district court properly found when it granted summary judgment, is the bank didn't even bring an affidavit saying we searched our records and didn't see the notices in our records. Anything to say that they weren't mailed to them. They brought nothing in response to a summary judgment motion. And now they're here complaining, well, they abandoned their 56F relief. Justice Hardesty, that was one of the first lines I had written down, was that they abandoned their request for 56F relief, and they don't need 56F relief, and they don't need to go back to search their own records. They knew it was summary judgment, and they brought nothing to say there's a question of material fact as to whether these were mailed. The burden is on them to show the non-existence of a presumed fact is more probable than its existence under Yeager. So this goes to your question, Justice Perigeri, is the question of notice. Again, not the purchaser. There's notices that are out there, and the law is presumed to have been followed. The burden is on the bank to try and reinstate it, and it's on the bank to even show that the purchaser isn't a VFP. That's their burden. They are trying in equity to reinstate some property interest. It's not on the person holding title. And that's out of a case in California that was cited in the briefs. But the question about 107.090 being incorporated, we know that there's been multiple cases that are unpublished coming out of a number of panels stating that about the incorporation and talking about the dissent in Bourne Valley. Reality is this court and SFR, and as I have argued before this court every time, the SFR court acknowledged the incorporation of 107.090 and that notice was required to be sent to the banks. And Fatikoi didn't say it doesn't exist or that we've never decided it. What it says is for the issues before it that day on constitutionality, it didn't need to reach the question. It didn't need to even discuss it, because that wasn't the question before it. And to keep putting on to this court that it's supposed to go further than it should, when the court is doing exactly what it's supposed to do under the constitutional avoidance doctrine, is something that shouldn't be asked of it. I think the court is taking the cases before it with the facts before it and making the decisions it needs to. So the incorporation of 107.090 was discussed in Shadowood, discussed in SFR in both the majority and the dissent, and the recent orders from both this panel and others stating incorporation and recognizing the dissent in Bourne Valley. Therefore, I think the bank has nothing to complain of about that. As far as their complaints about commercial reasonableness in the sale and what should be looked at, it's this court, if it was to adopt the 20%, would be announcing new law. Long Beach Town was an HOA. And it adopted Golden. It looked at Golden. Golden has been around since the 60s. It looked at Oller. There are four or five pages in the opening brief asking this court to adopt the grossly unreasonable standard, when this court already looked at all those cases back in Golden and said, we've looked at all of them. We're not adopting it. We're adopting Oller. We're adopting inadequacy of price, however gross, will not be enough to unwind a sale. And let's be clear, every case we're talking about is unwinding a sale. There is absolutely no support in any of their cases to make a purchaser, and a bona fide purchaser at that, take subject to their deed of trust. Nothing. They, either the sale was good and they unwind it, good for all purposes, or it's not. And to complain about, you know, we're complaining about the notices and what was in there. They're asking this court to impose a burden on the HOAs beyond what the statute requires. They're trying to turn every HOA sale into a judicial foreclosure, and it's got to stop. You don't get to come into court, complain about the notices when you didn't complain about them when you got them. You didn't come into court and say, stop this sale because I can't figure out what to do, and get an injunction, which is exactly what my client had to do when HSBC attempted to judicially foreclose behind the sale, the HOA sale. They want the courts to give them all this equity when they sat on their rights. They did nothing, and they had notice. Let's be clear. HSBC took its assignment after the HOA sale. It's got nothing to complain about. It knew it was already extinguished. As far as the burdens, if you have any questions on the burdens, I think the biggest one is when you're looking at burdens, and I said this, but I didn't actually give you a citation for it, is that if you're looking to claim equitable title, the person who's seeking equity is to allege and prove the person holding legal title is not a bona fide purchaser. First Fidelity Thrift and Loan Association v. Alliance Bank, 60 Cal App 4th, 1433. The bank is trying to show that its lien was not presumptively extinguished. Because SFR says the proper sale, and remember, the sale is presumed valid and properly conducted. So when there's a proper sale, then it's their burden to prove every aspect to be able to overturn that sale. And that there's so much policy behind protecting a bona fide purchaser. And to be clear, knowledge of a deed of trust, I think Shadowwood said this the clearest, knowledge of a deed of trust and that somebody may challenge the sale later in equity, like a former homeowner or the banks, is not enough to defeat bona fide purchaser. Neither is a low price without some other facts that you would learn from the public record. And the public record here is clear. CC&Rs, deed of trust, following it, followed by notice of delinquent assessments, notice of default, notice of sale. Nothing releasing super priority lien, nothing about a dispute, nothing that we didn't get notices, nothing saying that there was a problem with this sale in any way, shape, or form. And to the extent that they complain about anything, the purchaser didn't cause it, the purchaser didn't create it, and the purchaser should not be the one who has to bear the burden if there is something wrong with the sale. It's the person conducting the sale. That's what it says in the restatement. That's what it says under California law. That's what bona fide purchaser here is. If you look at the UCC cases, in most of those cases, the sale wasn't overturned. Damages were awarded. And I think this court needs to make it clear that these banks are not coming with clean hands. They're asking for things beyond the statute. And it should be stopped, and they should simply seek relief, if they're entitled to any at all, from another person. Thank you.
Gentlemen, how do you want to proceed on your time?
I'm going to try to keep it to a minute, Justice Hardesty.
I think you have collectively 3 minutes or so, a little over that.
I just want to make sure we're on the same page there. I see that we had 2 minutes and 2 seconds.
I understood, Justice, that you offered 1 minute.
Why don't you both take 2 minutes and move on?
We'll each have 2 minutes. Thank you, Judge. Long versus Stone was an HOA sale, but it was decided before Nevada adopted the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, so it was not a super priority then sale. The legislative history on the uniform, when Nevada adopted the UCIOA, I think is telling. We included as part of our appendix at page AA693, and it makes a reference to the sources. And it has, again, this is part of our record, on section 1-113, a notation, obligation of good faith, and it says compare NRS 104-1203, parentheses, UCC. So even the legislative history makes clear that the good faith concept is directly borrowed from the UCC. Questions, at least in the Sattaquai Bay versus Nation Star case, the questions of presumption, burden of proof, and bona fide purchaser are not before the court. They are waived. With respect to burden and presumptions, there was no argument on that at all in the briefs and in the district court's order. Same with unclean hands and with respect to the adequate remedy of law, this is quiet title action, so we don't believe that applies. Thank you. Okay. Am I wrong? Do I have 45 seconds?
You do.
And then he has 2 minutes.
He does.
Sorry, I was trying to rush.
And before you make a clean getaway, I have a question.
Yes. Be happy to spend the last 30 minutes, seconds on it.
One of the reasons we sought oral argument in this case, although that may not have been, apparently wasn't as apparent to you all as it was to us, is the meaning or significance of the language used in the Shadowwood case that mentions the 20% rule in the restatement. And my question to you is whether you have researched and have information for the court about the source of the restatement's reference to the 20%.
As it happens, Justice Hardesty, last week my office submitted a brief that actually overtly asks the court to adopt the restatement officially as opposed to Golden. That's in that case, so that'll be coming your way. And as part of that, we did research that extensively. The restatement did an exhaustive analysis of two strains of cases, one that mentions gross inadequacy and another strain that mentions a price that shocks the conscience. And in the review of cases going all the way to the 1860s and the U.S. Supreme Court case dating from there, the majority, and I think the language that the restatement uses, the vast majority of the cases, set this rule that you don't discount or you don't expect market value because you understand that in a foreclosure sale there are risks and you discount it. And the discount goes to 20% because that's generally where the judicial practice seemed to be in the eyes of the restatement. They made clear that it's a little bit arbitrary. They said that you cannot define it specifically in every case, but that generally under 20% is presumptively grossly inadequate. And the further down you get down that price ladder, the more it almost becomes abusive of the court's discretion to not set aside the sale. And here in the Sattaquai Bay case, at least we're at 10%, which is half of that minimal demarcation point. But I do think that the source of that was just judicial experience over the last 120 years or so before the restatement.
Does the 20% seem somewhat arbitrary? I mean, why couldn't it be 10%, 30%? Where'd they come up with 20%?
I think it was a considered compromise between the concept that you don't expect full market value at a foreclosure sale because of the risks that are inherent in a foreclosure sale. And on the other hand, there is a point at the very extreme end where there just has to be some value salvaged for the sale to be minimally fair. And I think 20%, they explained very clearly that, and in fact, I think the words they used were, you cannot do this in every case. It's going to be case by case, but 20% is
that
a general
guideline. Each sale involves a unique circumstance.
Each fellow, right.
To come up with a hard and fast dividing line, that's fairly appropriate.
Well, I think what they said was the guideline, it's guidance, much like, you know, there's other areas in the law where you don't get strict guidance. Like, for example, what would a reasonable person do?
That, you know, well, wasn't the source of this a survey done in 1997 of foreclosure cases around the country, which showed that sale prices had been somewhere between 10 or 30 or higher or lower, and 20% was sort of picked as a random number. Wouldn't that number fluctuate depending upon market, depending upon lots of different conditions? I just wonder why this court should adopt a hard and fast number and say, if you're above it, then she's okay. If you're below it, she's not. And it doesn't matter whether it's 19.8 or 20.7.
I don't think, I certainly don't.
That doesn't make sense to me.
Candidly, it doesn't make 100% sense to me either, but we have not asked for that, and the restatement does not require that. The restatement is a
general. I understood that's precisely what you were requesting, at least in your brief in this case.
I was
to adopt. Don't you advocate in this case that you want the court to set a hard and fast 20% rule, and that if we do, you prevail in this case?
I believe that's how we started. That's how it came across. That was intentional, Justice Hardesty. What we ask is, and what we will ask in cases going forward, is that the court adopt the restatement. But the restatement is not a rigid rule. The restatement itself says that it's in the neighborhood of 20%. It's in the court's discretion. The key difference between the restatement and Golden is not that. The key difference is, I think the restatement just gives a little flavor to Golden versus Tomayasu as to what the neighborhood is for a grossly inadequate price. The key difference is that Golden has no exception in any case. Sale could be for a dollar. Golden versus Tomayasu gives no exception for that. The restatement does. In our view, that's the real difference between the two approaches.
Thank you. You've used all of your counsel's time, but he'll still get it.
Thank you for suffering me to get back up for just a brief period, Justices.
You're right to characterize it that way. I'm just giving you a bad time.
We appreciate it, Justice Hardesty. We'll be brief.
I am so grateful for the advocacy that you lawyers provide in these cases. They are challenging. If we didn't get a chance to tease you once in a while, it wouldn't be fun at all.
That's true, Justice. Just a few quick things here, and then I'd like to speak to the question you were just discussing with counsel. A few quick things on the matters we've been discussing. First, they are plaintiffs, and in the quiet title action, they do bear the burden as movement, and they can't casually flip the Rule 56 burden back to us. It's still there, the plaintiff, and there is Rule 56. And there was no real response to the suggestion that I made to your honors about how in 2012 you can't know what the law is going to later be declared to be, even if it's sort of a convenient resolution of the problem. And so counsel says, well, the law is presumed to be followed. It begs the whole question I presented for 8 minutes earlier, which is which law? NRS 116 that didn't on its face within its four corners require notice to my client, or NRS 107 that does? That's the whole problem with cases with no discovery in them, which is why it's great when they get sent back. And I didn't paraphrase. I read a straight quote from Sadikoi Bay, quote, "We need not determine whether NRS 116-3116 at SEC incorporates the notice requirement set forth in NRS 107. Nobody's trying to ask the court to, you know, be pushed to do things it doesn't want to do. The court can decide that question whenever it likes, but respectfully, that text indicates it wasn't previously decided. And finally, on BFP, their brief has the distinguishing feature at answering brief pages 30 and 31 of calling what they did, buying this kind of house, buying a risky investment that's buying a lawsuit. You're not a BFP when you write in your appellate brief to the Nevada Supreme Court, you're buying a lawsuit. 20% is completely arbitrary, but bright line rules are good because they give prospective guidance to litigants. And if you went with 20% and thought it was arbitrary, you could create a rebuttable presumption above, a rebuttable presumption below that that could be rebutted that it was commercially unreasonable, and above, a rebuttable presumption that it was reasonable, allowing fact-specific development, but still giving a rules of the road to litigants. That's my 2 cents, Your Honors.
Thank you. As I said before, I'm grateful for the argument of counsel. I know my colleagues are. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments today, and the two cases will stand submitted.